Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
This episode of Astronomy Cast is brought to you by Swinburne Astronomy Online, the world's longest-running online astronomy degree program. Visit astronomy.swin.edu.au for more information.
Astronomy Cast, episode 217 for Monday, January 24th, 2011. Stellar classification. Welcome to Astronomy Cast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. My name is Fraser Kane. I'm the publisher of Universe Today, and with me, as always, is Dr. Pamela Gay, a professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Hi, Pamela. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Fraser?
I'm doing great. I got nothing else to say. You have anything interesting to say?
Life is good.
Okay, well, on that note,
there's a shuttle launch coming.
That's true. Yeah. So on that note, let's get into the show then. Chit-chat over. Chit-chat done. right. So have you ever heard an astronomer utter these words? Oh, be a fine girl and kiss me. Now, they're not being romantic. They're just trying to remember the different ways to organize stars, as detailed nicely on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So let's find out what all those letters mean and what differentiates a type O star from a type G star. I know this is the show that everybody's been waiting for. but sometimes, you know, sometimes we'll talk about the really cool, crazy stuff, and sometimes we'll go back to the fundamentals to stop your eyes from glazing over as you flip through the pages of an astronomy book and you see this big picture of all these stars and you're like, whatever that is, I'm moving on. No, stop. Time to understand it. So yeah, that is the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, and it is a way of organizing the different stellar stages, classifications.
Everything about stars, their fuel, their evolutionary stage, their temperature, how bright they are, it all gets trapped in this one diagram.
And normally, you know, I think we try to sort of let people just imagine with their minds. But in this case, if you actually did want to go and Google up yourself a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, that might be helpful.
As we
continue today's conversation. But even, you know, not, you know, I think there's enough here for everybody that even those of you on a forest walk can envision stars collected into this graph. So, all right. So what are we talking about here? And why does this even matter?
Well, the reason it matters is because we're scientists. We need graphs. We require graphs. And in this one particular case, if you make a graph of stars that are at the same distance and put on one axis how bright they appear and put on the other axis what temperature they are, what color they are, it's the same thing, you start ending up with these really nice lines along which the stars naturally clump up. And those lines have physical meaning. There's this beautiful curvy S that, well, it's mostly like an S that you stretched and stretched and stretched until it was almost a straight line. And that S that starts in the upper left-hand corner, it's kind of rotated 45 degrees, and ends in the lower right-hand corner, that's what we call the main sequence of stars. And it's along that line that all stars that are burning hydrogen in their core exist, as well as all other stars that are in their first stage of burning nuclear fuels.
Okay, so imagine that graph. The left-hand, I guess the vertical axis is mass.
Vertical axis. Well, mass actually doesn't play into the diagram that much. If you look around on diagonals, you can get there. But the vertical axis, the y-axis, it's how bright the star appears.
Okay. Right. So the vertical axis is brightness, and the horizontal axis is color, right?
Yes. And we have blue on the left and red on the right, which is hot on the left and cool on the right.
Right. And so in the very upper left-hand corner of the graph, you're going to get a star that is very bright and very blue. And in the bottom right-hand corner, you're going to get a star that is not so bright and red.
Exactly.
And as you say, you get this line that goes from the upper left-hand corner quite smoothly moving down towards the lower right-hand corner. Although, as you say, it's a bit of an S.
And this curve, one of the things that makes it so important is how much of this letter S we get to see is a function of how old the stellar population we're looking at happens to be. So if you look at a very young group of stars, an open cluster, a group of stars that is still in the process of forming, you'll get all the stars in the upper left-hand corner. And if it's still in the process of forming, you're probably going to be missing some of the stars down in the lower right. But if you look at an extremely old population of stars, something like a globular cluster, those really hot, really bright, really massive stars in the upper left-hand corner, they're going to be dead. They're going to have evolved off this letter S, this main sequence, to a different part of the diagram. So we can actually use this diagram for a cluster of stars to figure out exactly how old that cluster of stars happens to be.
You look at how many of the stars have evolved off the main sequence.
Exactly. What's the turning point is the way we talk about it.
So then where does this come from? I mean, someone had to have made some kind of realization at some point. I'm guessing their names are somehow involved with the name of the diagram itself.
It might just have been, well, I can't pronounce this poor guy's first name, Ejnar Hertzsprung. And then, of course, Russell is Norris Russell. So these two, Henry Norris Russell, these two astronomers at the same time working between 1911 and 1913 came up with the refinements for this diagram. But what's interesting is actually the history behind that, O be a fine girl, kiss me. That
No, I mean, that's a puzzler, right? I mean, what does O or G have to do with the actual colors?
And the thing that bothered me when I first saw this diagram is, why aren't they in order? And this all goes back to our understanding of spectral classifications. People started taking spectral images of stars. This is where you take the starlight and you shine it through a slit, a prism, a grism, any of many different combinations of things. And as a result, you end up with the light spread out into a very fine-grained rainbow where you can see where light gets absorbed out by the atmosphere of the star and where there's extra light due to emission lines in the atmosphere of the star. And we didn't actually understand that when people started taking stellar spectras. We didn't understand what role temperature played when we started taking spectras. And so these were just a really neat way of getting additional information, these neat lines on the rainbows of these stars. And the first people to try and figure out how to sort out what these spectra meant were two of Pickering's women at Harvard. So on one hand, you had Antonia Mori, who was, well, Henry Draper, the famous Henry Draper of the Draper Catalog's niece. And she came up with this really complicated system that looked at the widths of the lines and what the lines were. And it had some basis in physical reality, but we didn't understand that at the time. And then there was Wilhelmina Fleming, who looked at the lines and took a very straightforward approach. She knew what the hydrogen bomber series was. She knew what those lines were in the stars. And she classified the stars such that A stars had the most prominent hydrogen bomber lines. And as you worked your way down the alphabet, the bomber lines slowly disappeared.
So this is where you get like A, B, C.
Exactly, except right. We got rid of some of the classifications. C went away, D went away.
Because they just weren't distinct enough from the others?
Well, and it turned out once we understood that the prominence of these different lines has to do with the temperature of the gas, that they just weren't needed. And so it was realized O stars were, oh dear, these were the hottest. And so they got jumped all the way over to the left-hand side of the graph. We realized A stars, they're still pretty hot, but they're cooler than those O stars, and the B stars are partway in between. And so as we started to pick out what are all the different lines? What are all the different spectral lines that correspond to different temperatures in these stellar spectra? What do they mean? We're able to pick it apart and figure out, oh, if you look at these very particular to hot star lines, you get O stars. And G, if you start looking at how the hydrogen lines have started to get weaker, you get G stars. So we built up this entire classification system based on temperature, using the original letters that were ascribed to literally thousands of classified spectras that were classified before we had a good physical meaning for the system.
But because people were so comfortable with using those letters to describe the stars, they kept them, even though now they're just not in order anymore.
Exactly. And what's kind of neat about this story is the woman who sat down and tried to figure out the argument on how to classify spectra, the disagreement between Antonio Mori's system and Wilhelmina Fleming's system, when she looked at it and came up with the physical interpretations, she initially kind of more than annoyed Antonio Mori, who left Harvard for a while. But as she examined it, she realized that Antonio's usage of the thickness of the lines actually had physical meaning. When you start making plots that have not just temperature along one axis, but then you make it two-dimensional, you add that second axis, you add that luminosity in, she found that the stars that have different thicknesses of lines, these are the dwarf stars, the supergiant stars, the subdwarfs, these different thicknesses of lines clumped up as well and had physical meaning as well. And now we know the thickness of the line is at least in part due to how strong gravity is at the surface of the star.
So why don't we take a walk down the main sequence anyway, and see where some distinct classifications of stars, because even though it is fairly smooth, they do kind of clump up a bit.
Right. So we have pretty much through the middle of this diagram, the central curvy bit of the S. There's, if you can imagine, the top part of the S and the bottom part of the S, and then you have the two parts in the middle. Those two parts in the middle, those are the dwarf stars. And our own sun counts as one of these dwarf stars. These are stars that are burning hydrogen in their center. These are stars that usually have additional layers that aren't completely involved in radioactive processes yet. They're nice, happy, generic stars that aren't going to explode in violent ways. Those are the giant stars that aren't the red giants. They're not the super giants. These are just the physically giant stars that exist in the upper left-hand corner. They very quickly become super giants and blue giants as they very quickly dive off the main sequence before exploding as supernovas. And then in the bottom part of this diagram, that bottom part of the S, we have the red dwarfs. These are stars that in some cases are involving their entire atmosphere in nuclear burning. They're completely convective, and they're going to burn their entire store of hydrogen over time and then very gently cool off into tiny, tiny white dwarfs. And that's that main S part of the curve.
And sorry, just with the letters, the blue stars associate with the O and the B?
Exactly.
And then in the middle part, it's the A, F, and the G?
AF are generally thought of as being white. The human eye doesn't really perceive stars as green at any point. It's just the way stars give off light in all colors. And when we look at a star that might be giving off the majority of its light in the green, it's giving off lights in other colors as well, and our eye ends up perceiving it as white. So we have A and F stars are perceived as white by the human eye. And then as we cool off and get into the G and K stars, these are yellow-orange stars. And then it just slowly tapers off into the deep reds as we start to get into the M's. And some classification systems will add an L in after that.
And so when you hear about an M dwarf, that is a star, like a red dwarf star that's in that M classification.
And Barnard's star is perhaps one of the most famous red dwarfs out there, other than, of course, the spacecraft.
Right, the TV show, yeah. Okay, now, and again, if you look at the diagram, there's that main sequence we've been talking about, and there, and then there are stuff that's off the main sequence, which I know we've talked about. So what's going on here?
So the easiest part of this to explain is if you jump down below that letter S, running parallel to the straight part of this diagram, spanning from just around the letter B and then cooling all the way off, is this diagonal line of very, very faint stars. These are stars the brightness of the red dwarfs, or even fainter. And these little tiny stars that start off at high temperatures and then cool off are our white dwarf stars. So the death stage of stars like our sun, stars a little bit bigger than our sun and everything smaller than our sun, is a white dwarf. And white dwarfs are the degenerate matter, the stellar fragment that is no longer undergoing any nuclear reaction that we think structurally in some cases might actually resemble diamonds. These are crystalline carbons with the electrons in what's called an electron degenerate gas.
And so they do follow their own cluster, but it is away from what the rest of the stars, because as you said, they're no longer actively burning. They're really just cooling down from what they used to be. And I guess the situation is that we only really see them up into the sort of white level because there aren't many stars, you know, there aren't many cooler stars that have had a chance to die yet.
Yeah, this is one of those things that people don't really think about. In some cases, our understanding of stellar evolution is more advanced than what the universe allows us to look at. The universe has only been around for 13.7 billion years, and it takes white dwarfs a long time to, first of all, get formed. You have to wait for the not low mass, but lower than giant, giant mass stars to finish their entire life cycle. And then you have to wait for these things to cool off to see what is the end stage of their existence, which we believe they just cool off like a barbecue briquette, basically. So we're only able to see some parts of this pattern, and they're faint, so that makes them even harder to see. And as they cool off, they give off even less light, but they do place a constraint on the age of the universe. If we see a white dwarf that had to have had longer than the age of the universe to cool off to get where it is on the HR diagram, we know there's something wrong with our understanding of the universe. But so far that's never happened, so we're doing okay.
And then, so that's one of the off the main sequence, but there's another one too.
There's multiple other ones. So the other big one is the red giant branch. This is where pretty much all the big boys go to die. That's kind of a depressing way to look at it. But as stars evolve off the main sequence and proceed to start doing other things, such as burning a shell of hydrogen around their core, they'll evolve into this diagonal line that comes off of the center of the letter S. And at this stage, they've bloated up, they're much cooler, and they're now undergoing a different form of burning.
Right. And so they're bright according to the graph, but cool. So they're more towards that red color, but they're also then brighter. So they're, as you said, it's almost like a cross. They're going the other direction from the main sequence.
And so this, if you imagine just the main sequence and the giant stars, we now have a backwards letter Y in our diagram. Now, coming off of that giant branch, we have, in some cases, in older systems with just the right combinations, we have a small branch, a horizontal branch, extending straight left-right through the HR diagram. And this is where you end up with stars that have undergone a helium flash in their core. These are stars that are now burning helium with a shell of hydrogen around them. And depending on exactly what they're in the process of doing, they could either be evolving towards the left or they could be evolving towards the right, which is one of the things that makes studying stellar evolution particularly confusing at times, because you're looking at a star and without additional data, you're not quite sure which way it's moving in its evolution. what's neat is this horizontal branch cuts through the what's called the region of instability, which is a region that cuts along a mostly vertical line through the entire HR diagram, and stars all along this instability strip pulsate. So on the horizontal branch, stars in this instable region, these are your Aurolari stars. These are your pulsating variables. If you move up the strip, there's another horizontal branch as well. These are the supergiant stars. This is where the largest stars are burning shell after shell after shell of material. And in here, you also start to find your Cepheid branch stars.
And so this is where you get, as you said, when a really giant star first forms, it's briefly on the main sequence and then puffs up, gets very bright, but and can either remain hot or can be cooler, but is, you know, completely steps away from all of the main sequence brightness, color connection.
Right.
And they don't last long.
No, not at all. And what's neat is across this entire diagram, if you're able to get in a mass of a star and you're able to plot its point on this diagram, you can figure out all sorts of information from what it's burning in its core to where it's been in its life to what's likely to happen to it in the future. Using this diagram, we are able to use populations of stars to understand the lives of individual stars. When we use the HR diagram, we'll say, okay, let's look at that globular cluster. All those stars are at about the same distance. They're all made of about the same stuff. And so the only thing that makes these stars different from one another is their mass. Now we can look at multiple globular clusters to find out, how does the HR diagram differ? How does stellar evolution differ as a function of mass for systems that have slightly different amounts of metals in them, slightly different amounts of iron and other elements, everything other than hydrogen and helium we consider a metal. And by putting together the pictures of all these systems at different ages, all these systems at different metallicities, we can start to say very specifically, a star like our sun will have this specific future. And that's kind of neat to learn all from a graph.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me how you can, I mean, you can show an astronomer a star and they'll know what the color is by, you know, by analyzing the light. And then they can look at what the apparent brightness is and then they can know, you know, roughly how far away the star is because they know how bright, based on this graph, a star like that should be. And they can, or they can know, you know, what stage of evolution it's in. You know, they can know, they can guess at its mass. I mean, it's in, because they have this great relationship, this on this graph. It's amazing what an astronomer can figure out. And I can see how what's really fascinating is where, what are the nuances? How is it different? As you said, you know, you look at one globular cluster and the stars have all taken some strange shared direction down the HR diagram. Well, it's different from a different cluster. And so there's these similarities and these differences. And that, I'm sure, tells astronomers tons.
It's strange to think that one graph, one lousy graph that we torture students with by making them make them by showing them plots of the nearest stars, this one graph holds so many keys to our understanding of the universe. We use it for everything.
Now, is this the only way that astronomers will express this kind of thing? Are there other graphs like this that people might encounter?
When it comes to trying to understand stars, we make pretty much consistently graphs of color or temperature or spectral type, which are three different ways of saying the same type of information, versus in an ideal situation, the absolute magnitude or total luminosity of the stars. And when we don't have that information, if we're looking at stars that are all at the same distance, we just make a plot versus how bright they appear to be. That's pretty much what we do. We call it different names at times. We'll call it color magnitude diagrams or Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, but it's really the exact same thing.
And I guess, you know, neutron stars, black holes, they don't show up on this.
No, not so much. Neutron stars, you could figure out where to put them, but they're just cooling off as well. And they're generally not known for being observed by how bright they appear. We like to look at how brightly they pulse instead. It's just a different way of starting to consider things.
What about objects that are like before they're forming as stars, you know, like Titari objects, things like that?
So objects, protostars, as they're in the process of forming, these objects start off slightly cooler and slightly brighter in some cases. And so they drop on to the main sequence.
As opposed to branching off. That's interesting. All right. Well, I think that's good. I think hopefully now everyone, when they see an HR diagram, will know what they're looking at and not just flip the page immediately.
It's a graph, but it's a good graph.
It's key. So, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
This has been Astronomy Cast, a weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos. Show notes and transcripts for every episode are available on our website. Check it out at astronomycast.com. You can send us any comments, questions, or feedback to info@astronomycast.com. We read every email. The show is a nonprofit educational resource provided by Fraser Kane and Dr. Pamela Gay. We're supported through the kind donations of listeners like you. If you enjoy Astronomy Cast, why not give us a donation? It helps us pay for bandwidth, transcripts, and show notes. Just click the donate link on the website. All donations are tax deductible for U.S. taxpayers. You can support the show for free, too. Write a review or recommend it to your friends. Every little bit helps. Click support the show on our website to see some suggestions. To subscribe to the show, point your podcatching software at astronomycast.com/podcast.xml or subscribe directly from iTunes. Music is provided by Travis Searle. The show was edited by Preston Gibson. Astronomy Cast is produced at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville with generous support from Universe Today.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.